Okay, the meeting of Civil Justice Committee will come to order. There's clearly a quorum.
Representative Mahoney moves the minutes to February 25th. Everybody, no opposition. Okay, all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carry. Representative Famer, you had him.
Mr. Chair, yeah, I would move to reconsider House File 130, and would have a motion after, if that passes.
After the motion to reconsider. Okay. Hopefully there's no discussion of that. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no.
No.
Carry. Representative Famer, you have a...
Mr. Chair,
actually, Representative Pimer, we would then be on the motion by Representative Hellstrom to pass and re-refer it to her committee.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I guess I don't really have anything to add to that motion. I don't believe that there have been any changes. Representative Bigham is here. I just
Representative Paymer, I'm sorry, the motion would be by Representative Hillstrom, I believe it was to pass as amended.
Okay.
With those colon, semicolon, and comma.
Okay.
To her committee. I apologize for not saying that right in the first place.
Okay, well,
I think we've
heard the bill enough.
Representative Hillstrom. Yeah, we've heard it for an hour and a half. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would ask for a roll call.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative
Thank you. When Representative Bingham came to talk to some of us about this being reconsidered, she stated she was going to make some changes to the bill, so I'm wondering what kind of changes we're looking at. Number one and number two, I did have a handout that I asked you passed out. Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Goldberg.
Bigham, is that the... Representative Bigham?
There were no changes to the bill. Some conversations that I had, I think members just needed some clarification on the bill.
Representative Holbrook.
Mr. Chair and Representative Bingham, that wasn't my recollection of the conversation that was had, but I'm trying to look for the language on the computers where you add the computers here. You go on the bottom of page 5. I'm just wondering, and this is going to another committee, so maybe you can fix it, but the language here on 5 talks about the inmate, person, vehicle, premises, computer, and I would assume that if you don't want a sex offender on the computer, you don't want them on any computers, not just the inmate's computer. And so the way that this is drafted, referencing the inmates, I don't think is getting to what you want to do. I would recommend that you put a new sentence in there that would limit use of any computer access to these types of things, if that's what you're really trying to accomplish.
Representative Holbrook, I will work with the AG's office and with staff to come up with language that would get up at that intent.
And Mr. Chair, so that is your intent, that they not be on any computer, not just their own computer.
Representative Bingham.
Mr. Chair and Representative Holbrook, I guess I will check with staff and with the... My intent is that I want this to be the strongest bill we have coming out of here. And so if that is the strongest case, then that's what we would proceed with, and I would have some language to do that. But my point is that I would prefer to work with staff and the AG's office to make sure that we have the correct language and the strongest language.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Fortman.
Mr. Chair, I was just going to mention that portion of the bill pertains to what can be searched, and so it doesn't pertain to what the person could use. So it's a more complicated issue if you want to draft an amendment about using any computer, but this particular part is just the part that expands the areas that can be searched from their person and their vehicle and their premises to include their computer.
Representative Phelps? No. Okay, seeing no further discussion, clerk will call the roll.
Representative Campion.
Aye.
Representative Jaskowski.
Aye.
Representative Hillstrom.
Aye.
Representative Holberg.
No.
Representative Hortman.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Kelly.
Aye.
Representative Kulik-Jackson.
Aye.
Representative Mahoney.
Aye.
Representative Olin.
Aye.
Representative Paymer.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
Aye.
Representative Westrom. Representative Mullery.
Carry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee.
Are out of here. Next bill is 887. Representative, oh, there's Representative Lutz. Representative Champion, do you want to move the bill? 887. Representative Lush, where does this go?
Mr. Chair, the requested motion will be that it be laid over. There are a few things that we're going to need to work out with DHS prior to this being ready for prime time.
Okay. Representative Lush wants the chair to lay over the bill after the testimony on both sides.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Go ahead, Representative.
Okay, briefly, and I have with me here, Mr. Chair, members, a constituent, Cindy Cunningham, who brought this issue to me. And Ms. Cunningham, if you can come up. This is a basic fairness issue in that if you need to have a judgment for child support collected from the obligor, that there's no reason that the obligee should have to pay for that collection, which is currently what is stated in law. This bill changes that, as stated. It's a basic fairness issue. That said, I believe the Department of Human Services are going to come forward with all kinds of counterintuitive reasons that the federal government has seen fit to ensure that states do the opposite of what we're trying to do. Nothing against the Department of Human Services, but I need to work through a few things to determine why this is and how we can achieve more fairness for those who are custodial parents who end up having to collect support from some of these folks. So with that, Mr. Chair and members, Cindy Cunningham.
Thank you.
Cunningham, was it?
Yes, Cunningham.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you. This is the first time for me to ever speak in this arena, so nervous as it is. Garnishment is a method typically used to collect money from individuals who are not being responsible for their obligation. Their obligation, as set forth by the courts, provides support for their children. In this arena, the obligation is to their children, and even though the money may be sent to an ex-spouse, the money is for the children. Whether the laws that govern child support laws are agreed to or not, the payment of child support of an individual's children is against the law. Currently, the garnishment process costs $25 per year, and 1% of every dollar that is realized through garnishment is withdrawn. Currently, my children's father has been presented with over $5,000 worth of medical bills. He has yet to pay for any of those bills or even respond. The 1% would be approximately the $50. It does not seem like a lot. As currently, I receive no child support because the child support laws were adjusted last year also. So no child support, and I lose the 1% and the $25 a year. Considered, though, that with that $5,000, I have already paid $10,000 of medical bills and paid the interest associated with attempting to fund the expenses of my children. There is a cap of approximately $650 per year for associated with my case, but it's the maximum amount that I can be held responsible for to obtain the garnishment dollars per year. That would be $650 that my children lose. Last year, the process for submitting medical bills was changed. Instead of presenting my case directly to the courts, I now submit paperwork to the state courts, state and county courts. That means that I compile EOBs, medical bills, receipts, payment records, and triplicates, send one copy to their father, wait 30 days, then send into the state county for evaluation. Over the past 12 months, I have expended approximately $300 in copy fees and postage and over 40 hours of my time compiling the paperwork. This is after investing the time and effort into managing their medical care, making appointments, driving to appointments, managing the health care needs, establishing and maintaining relationships with providers, and follow-up care. Then I pay the bills, all of them. Daunting as it is, remember there is no child support being provided and no support for medical care being followed through by their father. Other needs for the children go on hold, dental appointments can't be made, and other health issues are put off as there isn't money to pay the bills. Then garnishment tries to collect. When they do, I lose even more money. Not huge, but not due to my neglect or and out of my responsibility. Parents' rights are not stronger than their responsibilities. I support this bill as it places the motivation and consequences where it should be, on the individual who is not being responsible. By realigning the costs associated with garnishment, it would take the sting out of the indebtedness that I experience financially every day. The question has been asked, though, how the state would recoup the money they need for revenue to manage the garnishment process. Keep the fees. I understand, and there was some conversation as an aside about the federal government laws and such, of which I am not privy to or fully understand. Those laws do need to be followed, but an accounting process could be set up where when the money is collected from the obligor through the garnishment process, that the individual not get 100% credit for everything that is collected, that the 1% would be kept with the state county, but that the individual, the obligor, would only get the credit for the amount of money that, in this case, I would actually receive. $500 collected, I would receive the less than 1%, but he would only get credit for the less than 1%. The government would keep the middle. So that would be the cover for the funding of that, if that makes sense. Excuse me? Okay. So instead of collecting it, well, instead of collecting the 1% from my loss, the 1% would, the accounting would be that he would only get credit for what is actually received by me, rather than what he actually comes up with. Does that make sense? I am not an accountant. Should be right now. If individuals are financially responsible in their role as parents and follow the agreement and rules set forth for their decrees, there is no concern or impact. They can continue to take care of their obligations without consequence. However, the system is not for those who are being responsible. It is for those who are not being responsible and who do not continue to punish those who are being responsible, such as myself, those maintaining financial care for their children. Please hold responsible those who are not following through by not making payments.
And
you can see I see
you have two sentences say what this bill is doing.
Yeah, I know, I'm sorry. You know, I'm not an accountant in either as Ms. Cunningham, but as you can tell, Ms. Cunningham has pored over many provisions in law to try to find a fair way that would make sense on this because it is so absolutely convoluted. What I think I may do, Mr. Chair, at this point is to tell you in basically it ensures that the person to whom child support is owed is not penalized because the person who owes the child support is not paying up. That's what this bill attempts to do. Now, other than that, what I think it may be worthwhile to do is for you to hear from the Department of Human Services. They have some reservations about this that follow federal provisions that cause it to be a problem.
I got a call from, I believe, somebody in the Hennepin County Department that said that glancing at this bill, they thought it took away the 1% that they got for collecting. Is that correct or is that incorrect? And maybe the department can clarify that.
Why don't we have the department clarify
it
that?
It sounded that your intent of the bill is to not have the 1% deducted from the obligees. Or amount that the obligee receives, but rather that it still stay as an amount owed by the obligor.
If I may have Ms. Cunningham comment on that.
I guess my intent in coming forward with this and trying to figure out how we don't lose the 1%, I get that as far as what needs to be collected. But again, I would receive only 99% if $100 comes, is collected through the guarantor through the program. I would still only receive the 99% or the $99. The government would collect the 1% out of that, but that the obligor would only receive credit for the $99 or the 99 that I received, rather than for the 100 that they actually collected.
Okay, and Representative Rush, I've got another question. This is only on ones where I believe the county attorney does the collection or the state. So isn't that sort of like getting a cheap attorney?
Well,
collect.
If I may, Mr. Chair, I don't believe that is the case. That was one of the things that I had looked at, but it was my intent in Ms. Cunningham's situation. That was not the case, as I understand it, for it was the county. The county attorney was not involved in your,
no.
Is that correct?
Oh, the county attorney?
No. So this goes beyond that, and I know that the explanation focuses primarily on the 4D services collection portion of it, but the intent of this is that it goes beyond that. The Department of Human Services issue was with respect to the 4D portion. So maybe we can have DHS testify, Mr. Chair.
Is there somebody from DHS? Could you come up? And could. Thank you. Could you state your name for the record?
My name is Jill Olson. I'm a staff attorney with the Department of Human Services and the Child Support Division.
Could you first of all explain what the bill does for us? And
my understanding of what the bill does is it deals with 4 fees that are charged in 4D child support case, or potentially charged in a 4D child support case. And those fees are first the federal annual fee, and what that does with the $25 federal annual fee is that shifts that fee. That fee is currently charged to the obligee in a child support case. It would shift that fee to the obligor. And that's currently the way the statute's written. It's a annual fee that's charged to obligee after $500 of child support has been collected, and only charged to obligees in non-public assistance cases. And the bill amends the current statute and would actually, in the case of a federal annual fee, would violate the federal regs by charging the fee without regard to the $500 collected and without regard to public assistance status. So it would now charge the fee to obligors in every case, whether or not they're public assistance or not, and whether or not $500 in support is collected or not. The second fee that, from what I understand that this bill deals with, is a federal tax intercept fee. And currently, right now, the IRS, every time child support is submitted for federal tax intercept, the IRS charges a $25 fee that the state in turn then charges currently to obligees in child support cases or recouped from obligees. And again, the federal rates, they require us to charge the obligee, so although this bill would shift the fee to the obligor, that would be contrary to the federal regs, which specifically require us to charge that fee to the obligee. In addition, this bill appears to charge a state tax intercept fee. Currently, we have the option of charging that fee. We don't currently charge a fee, but the way the bill's worded, it appears to charge a state tax intercept fee to obligors. And that would also violate the federal regs. As again, you know, we have the option of charging it. If we were to charge it, would have to be charged to obligee. The fourth fee that this bill deals with is the 1% cost recovery fee. That's currently a fee that's charged to the applicants on a child support case. So when someone goes to apply for 4D child support services, and that could be either an obligee or an obligor, and the vast majority of the cases it's going to be the child support obligee, then that obligee or obligor is charged a 1% fee. What this bill would do would shift that fee to the obligor in all cases. So instead of being the applicant now, which could be the obligee or obligor, but is usually the obligee, it would now automatically charge that fee to the obligor. And the department did consider, when this fee was implemented, it did consider charging that fee to the obligor. However, we looked at our ability to collect it, and It's easier to collect if we're able to collect it from the obligor. We can take it right off the support. I'm sorry, if we charge it to obligee, it's easier to collect. Therefore, we looked at that in determining who to charge that fee to, because under the federal regs, we could charge that to either the obligor or obligee, but a decision was made, determination was made that we'd be more able to collect that fee if it was charged to the obligee.
So that fee is one that you could, under the federal regs,
we have the option
either
of
way.
Charging it to either party. Right now it's neutral, meaning it's charged the applicant on a case. I shouldn't say it's always charged the obligee, because it's who applies for services that could be the obligor. It just usually is the obligee.
Okay, thank you. Representative Holberg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you tell us what the rationale is for making the person that's owed the money pay these fees when it's through no fault of their own, that these bills haven't been paid? I mean, it kind of seems unfair. It almost adds insult to injury. If somebody's not paying their child support or they're not paying the medical bills, et cetera, to have to go through all this rigmarole, and then they pay the $25 and the 1%. What's the rationale for that?
Ms. Larson?
All I can tell you is that the federal tax intercept fee and the state tax intercept fee are required to be charged to obligee. I don't know what the rationale behind, or why the federal government just, you know, went that way. I don't know that. The federal annual fee, we do have the option on, and I can't answer that question. They're mostly federally mandated, and I don't know the reason behind it.
Thanks. And Mr. Chair, and Representative Holberg, I'm assuming the answer is, as you stated, they can take it right off the top because the money's already in the conduit, or if they wanted to charge it to the obligor, it would be amount over and above the ordered amount. And so, you know, they'd have to take some extraordinary efforts to go out of their way to collect that. But picking it out of the amount that's already in the pipeline is just easier, I'm assuming. And I'm willing to bet that if we did change it, that the department would find a way to suggest that there's a fiscal note on that as well, just because it would involve doing some kind of collection action that they're not currently doing.
Well, Representative Lesh, I'm guessing that there's going to be a fiscal note no matter what on your bill. Representative Jackson.
Larson, is it?
Yeah.
I know at one time, the collection agency in the 4D unit could be used even in cases where the obligor was current. And is that current still the case? Or you have to be in default of your obligation before the 4D unit can be used?
Ms. Larson.
I'm not sure I understand the question.
If an obligor is current with their child support obligation,
mm-hmm.
Can the obligee still use the 4D unit for collection?
Yes.
Ms. Larson.
So then the obligor might be paying and keep current, and the obligor then could be assessed a federal fee?
Probably he would be assessed it. You can apply for 4D services whether or not, you know, as an obligee, you could apply for 4D services whether or not you're receiving support. I mean, you might want to apply for 4D services specifically for to have an accounting of the support that you're receiving. You're only required to be part of the 4D system if you are receiving public assistance, and you're automatically referred to and must cooperate with child support. If you were, you know, initially referred to child support because you were receiving public assistance, and then you closed on the public assistance, you would have the option at that point to opt out of the 4D system and not be assessed these fees. These fees are only part of the 4D system, and usually you're not required. Usually you're opting into the system by applying for services, or you're required because you're receiving public assistance.
If the obligee opts in voluntarily,
mm-hmm.
and and the obligor is current, can the obligor opt out, or is the obligor simply in the system?
He is simply in the system then.
Ms. Larson.
One follow-up. Then it would seem to me that the fairness argument works both ways. For an obligor who is in default, it is, as Representative Holberg said, insult to injury to have the obligee pay additional fees. If the obligor is current and the obligee simply opts gross collection, it adds insult to injury to have the obligor pay additional fees.
Ms. Larson.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
I smell a bill in the making. Representative Kulik Jackson, so you can carry that one.
Okay, or an amendment.
Representative Scott.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I think she answered my question, the question I was going to ask.
Okay. Representative Lesh, I don't see any more questions. I think you have some work to do on the bill. For one thing, you can't violate the federal regs. And the other one, you've heard there's some concern about the other parts. Representative Westrom?
Mr. Chair, just to Representative Jackson's point, that what Representative Lesh, is that something you're willing to maybe talk with Representative Jackson about? It seems like an inherent fairness issue.
Well,
the obligor shouldn't be obligated to have to pay when they've been current.
Representative Lesh, you'll be talking to
them. Mr. Chair, Representative Westrom, I'm open to discussing that. I'm really not interested in doing the legwork on it. My interest is in this fairness side of things. I haven't even explored the other side of it yet, and this one was brought to me by my constituent, so it's a priority. I'm willing to listen. I just don't want to have to do all the work on that side of it.
The bill is very good in its intent. I would simply suggest that it be limited to cases where the obligor is involved. You know, is not current. Then that's all. That's the only fix you need.
Okay, the bill is laid over. Thank you. Representative Mahoney, we'll have about 15 minutes of discussion on each side, or a little, maybe 12 to 15, and then leave the rest of the time for discussion by the committee. And any, I don't know, I think I saw one.
Mr. Chair, I think you probably have to go to at least 15 minutes. I have myself and the four testifiers that have shown up and given some distance, and hopefully we can leave enough time.
Okay, we'll just, you need 15 minutes, okay.
Yep.
And we'll give the other side then 15 minutes. And then
let me jump right into it, Mr. Chair.
And Representative Mahoney, I assume you...
I will take care of that as we come up to it, Mr. Chair.
Move House File 1003 for passage, and Representative Hillstrom has requested it for her committee.
Well, do you want the bill first, or... I'd like to pass it to the floor. I'm willing to discuss it once we've presented the bill, because I think the bill could change throughout committee, Mr. Chair.
Okay, well, you can make your motion as it is, and then somebody may...
We have to vote on it at some point.
Later, move to amend your motion. So Representative Mahoney moves House File 1003 for passage and re-referral to the General Register. Is that correct?
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
I'll explain the bill.
Is this an amendment?
If I might be able to, Mr. Chair, if I might be able to explain the bill.
Yes, go ahead.
House File 1003 is a bill with very strong passions on both sides. I will describe what the wording is and the intent of this law change. In 2005 session, Minnesota became the first state to include a presumption of parenting time, 25%, as long as Section 518.175 was met. In House File 1003 increases the parenting time to a 40% minimum if there's no issues under the best interest of the child. Then, as now, the real issue is about spending time with the children. Fathers in our culture have become so much more involved in children's care than in the 50s and 60s, the time when most family law is rooted in. Members, children become a reason for battles between parents, lawyers, and the courts. Is it fair to ask a parent to spend $50,000 or more to retain their rights as a parent? That is $15,000 more than the average debt a child will incur going through 4 years of college. If someone goes into court knowing they can parent up to 146 days a year, or less if they so choose, a parenting plan is easier to work out. And I believe we will see less lawyering over children. We will see, will we see all fighting go away? No, we will not. But children should never be used as a weapon, and if this bill prevents a percentage from having this happen to them, it's a good bill. Since the 25% took effect in January 1st of 07, no judge I have talked to, and I have talked and spoken to six, and the author of the 2005 compromise, who is the current sitting judge, and I passed out his comments just now, when asked, have not seen an increase over litigation over the 25% parenting time. And a number of them said that they found that it sped things up. I believe this bill will reduce litigation between couples because couples would know they would each have 40% time with their children, and 20% is not altogether that much to fight out over. It's easier to work out the remaining 73 days once each has 146 to start. Today, if you have up to 45% parenting time, you are allowed under our law, our child support law, a 12% discount on your child support. This bill will create two categories or discounts. One is a 12% if you have parenting time of more than 10%, but less than 30. One is of 30% if you have parenting time of more than 30%, but less than 45%. One example of how 40% would break out is included in the remarks on page 175 that were passed out. Every other weekend, Friday night to Monday morning, is 78 days or nights. Half of the summer vacation is 36 days. An equally divided school year breaks at 15 days, for a total of 139 days. Maybe somebody gets a birthday or a holiday. But, Mr. Chair, that's the extent of this bill. I have some testifiers that would like to come down. We'll start with, I'll allow most people to introduce themselves because I flatter most people's names.
Thank you.
Mark, you can introduce yourself to the tape.
My name is Mark Oshu. I'm from St. Cloud, Minnesota.
Thank you. Go ahead, Mr. Oshu.
Okay, good afternoon, Mr. Chair and representatives. I'd like to thank you for granting this opportunity for testimony in support of Mr. Mahoney's bill, House File Number 1003. I have a personal history of being involved in social justice issues. I was among one of the only white presidents of the NAACP in the entire country for about 3 years of the St. Cloud chapter. I'm also a recipient of the 2007 Virginia McKnight Binger Award in Human Service, and I continue to participate in St. Cloud Community Anti-Racism Education Initiative. I'm a very proud parent of a five-year-old boy who's named Teo. He was born on January 22, 2004. Unfortunately, I wasn't married, and to my son's mother at the time of his birth, I acknowledged that I was his father. I signed a recognition of parentage form to assure that I'd be part of his upbringing and on his birth certificate. But about a year after he was born, our relationship fell apart, and he and his mother denied me any access for a whole period of 3 months unless it was court-ordered. And the attorney I consulted with immediately urged me to file papers because, by Minnesota law, by not being married, I had no rights of any kind other than to pay child support. And his mother could take him and leave the state, and I potentially could never see him again. Due to the time it takes to schedule a court hearing, I had no contact for nearly 3 months, or it was 3 months. During the ensuing years, there have been many motions before the court, especially dealing with parenting time, and a custody trial lasting over 5 days wherein I was granted custody. But the cost of litigating basic rights has both been a financial and emotional loss for both parties. This is especially concerning the loss and the stress it has caused to an innocent child. Between the parties, over $150,000 has been spent on attorney fees and expert witnesses. It took at least 1.5 to 2/3 of that cost just to get to the starting basis that this bill would assure. Had the bill before you been signed into law at the time of my litigation, these costs could have been reduced by that 1.5 to 2/3, and 4 years of litigation could probably have been reduced to 1.5 to 2 years. Voting yes on this bill could have saved my case alone $75,000 to $100,000 between the parties, monies that could have better been spent invested in my son's future, his college education, rather than the children of my, our respective attorneys. I currently have over $50,000 in credit card debt. My son's mother used over $50,000 in pro bono attorney's fees from the state pro bono program, and she testified in court that she currently has a $30,000 loan against her parents. More importantly, all the financial losses here are the human loss, and due to the litigation taking so many years to stretch out over this, just getting basic parenting rights, my son is now having to see a play therapist on a weekly basis, and this will probably go on for another year or more. And I strongly believe that had I had the parenting time assured from the beginning, this could have been avoided. And there's also the issue of vastly different parenting styles where it has been next to impossible to impart my moral and spiritual values because of the differences in parenting style and what's gone on there. So with that, I strongly urge you to support this bill, to pass it, and especially also deal with the child support changes, because there is a huge difference between 10% parenting time and 45% that should also be accounted for. So thank you.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, Mr. Ochaka may have to leave. He's got to get his son to ECSE.
Yeah.
Okay.
If you do have any questions.
Who's your next witness?
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And after, I'm sorry.
My name is Richard Shea.
Okay. Molly Olson will be coming
up. Mr. Shea, go ahead.
Thank you for allowing me to testify. I'd like to share my family's divorce story because it's particularly relevant to this bill being proposed by Representative Mahoney. I am a divorced father of three children, now ages 18, 15, and 9. We were a typical middle-class family whose parents had grown apart after 15 years of marriage. We both had grown up in Minnesota, in the Burnsville area, and I attended St. Thomas University and then got my MBA from the University of Minnesota. Our divorce was finalized in Carver County on February 14th, of all days, 2006. After a lengthy five-day court trial and 1.5 years of expensive discovery and many pretrial hearings and negotiations, the court appointed custody evaluator for our case recommended that I be awarded sole physical custody and sole legal custody of our three children, with equal parenting time for both parents. The custody evaluator recognized that the children loved both parents, and both parents were fit, capable parents, or fit, capable adults. The custody evaluator also recognized that the children's mom was creating conflict involving our oldest daughter in the divorce, and would not encourage a situation where both parents were involved in the parenting of our children on a daily basis. Despite this, the Carver County Judge Philip Canning ignored his own court-appointed custody evaluator and ordered sole physical custody for my ex-wife with only 25% parenting time for myself. His findings were appealed to the Minnesota State Court of Appeals, where the appeal was denied, citing judicial discretion. A parenting consultant with full authority of the court was appointed, and both parents went to her on a regular basis. The parenting consultant ruled that my parenting time was to be increased to 40% plus because of my increased involvement would be in the children's best interest. I was the most active parent in education and in coaching my daughter's sports teams. Throughout the next year or so, my ex-wife repeatedly ignored the parenting consultant's directives and continued to deny visitation on a somewhat regular basis. Two motions to the court for denial of visitation were rejected without any hearing. The parenting consultant then subsequently quit because the judge would not enforce her decisions. Another parenting consultant was appointed, and she too believed that 40% plus, if not equal, parenting time was best for the children, and recommended but she could not recommend it based on the judge's decision for sole physical custody. The three experts in our family law case, one custody evaluator and two parenting consultants, who after spending lots of time with both parents and the children, recommended 40% or greater, if not equal, parenting time. The one Carver County judge who spent no time with the children and little time with the parents ordered the minimum 25% required by law. We have spent in excess of $100,000, probably each, that's both parents, $100,000 on my part, $100,000 on my ex-wife's part, in professional fees throughout the divorce to settle parenting schedules and other legal matters. 90% of our previous and ongoing litigation would have gone away with a fair presumption for 40% parenting time. Worse yet, we've essentially spent all our family finances, and our oldest child, as I said, is going to be in college next year. We have no money to help support her to get her an education that we both strongly believe in. That's $90,000 that could have gone to educate or feed our children that instead, at least on my part, double it with my ex-wife, could have gone to the children but instead went to attorneys or other professional fees. Family court is supposed to be about the best interests of the children, but in our view, both mine, it's not. It's about lawyer fees and the judicial system. Many judges are not properly trained in family law and view it as a nuisance. They have their own gender biases that they bring into the courtroom, and this impacts the fairness and the results of the decision. We need family laws that recognize that children are best off when parents are actively involved on a regular basis with the lives of their children. The 40% presumption for fit parents is a good place to start. It took me over $100,000 to essentially get the system to tell me that I could be a parent to my children. I coach their softball teams, I'm actively involved in their education, yet I had to spend that kind of money that could have been used for the children just to be a dad to my children. Thank you.
Representative Mahoney.
Do I have enough time left for Ms. Olson to come up? Thank you. Thank you very much.
Ms. Olson, would you state your name for the record?
Mr. Chair, my name is Molly Olson from Little Canada. I'm the founder and volunteer executive director of the Center for Parental Responsibility. I was also selected to be on the Minnesota State Court Joint Physical Custody Study Group, which met this last fall and was mandated in the spring of 2008 by this legislature. I've tried to cut my comments down to 3 minutes. They were five. I'm here to testify in favor of family law reform. I'm here to testify in favor of HS 1003 and in favor of a child's right to a presumption of at least 40% time with each fit parent. While I support this small change, I believe this bill does not go far enough to ensure the best interests of children, and that once again the legislature is failing in its duty to ensure that our laws comply with the constitutionally protected fundamental right of the parent-child relationship as supported by a long line of U.S. Supreme Court cases. I do support this bill, though, because it is progress. Our mission at CPR is to mobilize the masses who agree with our mission to remove the obstacles that prevent both parents from being fully and equally involved in the lives of their children. Why is this cause important? Well, it's widely known and widely accepted that we have a fatherhood crisis. We have a national epidemic of fatherlessness. The issue is not whether you believe that bias exists in family court or not, but the key issue that everyone should be concerned with is this question. Under what circumstances can children be taken away from fit parents? And under what legal authority, when such removal of fit parents is clearly limited by our Constitution and the U.S. Supreme Court? If the state law protected parental rights in family court the same way they protect Protection and Child Protection Court, we would clearly see that this forced fatherlessness in family court is a preventable tragedy. Government policy and outdated laws, as Representative Mahoney said, are based on outdated presumptions of gender bias and gender stereotypes that don't match what's happening in society today. For 25 years, there's been research and lots of it saying that this current model of sole custody to one parent and the other gets every other weekend is harmful to children. But the whole system's been resistant to change. because the divorce industry and the government bureaucracies flourish as long as one parent is removed. So family court practices and legislative public policy needs to change, because right now this best interest of the children has become nothing more than an empty cliché that authorizes the removal of one parent. According to child development experts and an endless amount of studies, to ensure the safety of children, the well-being of children, and to ensure well-adjusted children become well-adjusted adults, we need to do three things. We need to change this because, one, children need to maintain relationships with both parents, and the current law doesn't do that. Two, we need to, children benefit from parental cooperation and reduce conflict. The current system exacerbates conflict. Three, children need to be shielded from domestic violence. We all agree about that. But the current model actually causes more abuse. All three of these things could be changed with joint physical custody or equal shared parenting, which this bill tries to advance. The Minnesota State Court Joint Physical Custody Group, which I was a part of, study group, the majority report said there wasn't really enough research. That conclusion is nothing more than a stall tactic to ensure the status quo paralysis by analysis. The evidence is clear. Children need both parents, and a recent study came out from Canada just last week saying that 40% minimum is a minimum amount of time that children should be guaranteed with each parent when they are separated or divorced. So this bill, while it doesn't go far enough, will advance the well-founded premise that children need both parents and will maximize involvement by both parents. It will encourage cooperation, reduce conflict and litigation, and most importantly, it will convey to boys and it will convey to girls that their mothers and their fathers have equal value as parents. Because when children look in the mirror, they see half their mom and half their dad, and when one of them is diminished, they're diminished.
Okay, thank you.
Much time I got left?
None. Actually, I just got informed that there were two that called in advance and apparently were promised they could have a minute. Barbara Starr and Tim Kinley for it. So I'm going to allow that maybe about 30-40 seconds for each.
Mr. Chair.
I assume you're Barbara Starr.
I'm Barbara.
Representative Weston.
I would be supportive of us trying to hear as much as we can, and if we have to hold it over, I at least would be supportive of that. I know how tough this issue has been, and I just would encourage you to consider that. I understand the letter. I want to win the two. So.
Go ahead, Ms. Starr.
My husband got forced into this case in 1997. After 2 years and thousands of dollars in legal fees, with his lawyers twisting his arm behind his back, he reluctantly agreed to settle the case after the mother agreed to give him every weekend, 2 evenings a week, 4 weeks in the summer. But in order to get that time, he had to agree to pay her $100 over the guidelines. If this bill had been in effect at that time, he would have got a similar or better payment without having to pay extortion to get it. He has been through two custody fights with her because he has recurrent problems with methamphetamine. Both cases, over 2 years in length, thousands of dollars in legal fees. I would like to draw your attention to that parenting time adjustment, because under current law, if a parent had a 4-day, 3-day split, the parent with 3 full days would have 42.5% of the parenting time and would have to pay the same child support as somebody who sees a child every other weekend. They have the exact same overhead. There is virtually no difference in the expenses on child care in either household at that level. I would recommend that this be amended to reduce that figure from the 45.1 to at least 40%, the amount that has the presumptive amount, partly in the interest of payment of fairness, and also to reduce the financial incentives for custody fights, which the lawyers thrive on. To the extent that you pass bills that treat the parents as equal, you are reducing the incentive for lawyers. You're taking away the fuel that lawyers use to encourage custody fights. Right now in Minnesota, we have a de facto presumption of sole mother custody. Because we do not have a presumption of joint physical custody, judges almost always default to sole mother custody. And mothers know that. So when the judge comes in and he comes out at the beginning and he says, well, I'm going to give temporary custody to mom and the majority of the time, The judge has prejudiced the case right from the beginning. All the mother has to do is dig in her heels, drag on the case as long as possible, and the longer she drags it, the less likely that judge is to change the status quo that the judge created at the outset. I support this bill.
Okay, thank you. We have to go on, President Mahoney, to the other side now.
That's just fine.
We have four people that are listed from the other side, and...
And Mr. Chair and members, I have comments... Boxes and boxes of comments on this, if you ever care to see it.
Okay, and I'm sure there'll be discussion after the other side presents there. Why don't everybody come up on Michael Dittbrenner, Mary Louise Claus, Ron Elwood, and Lynn Norton, I believe, are the four on the other side. And so, is there a... Ms. Cunningham, are you going to testify again on this, or? Well, okay, if you're part of it, then it's 4 minutes apiece unless you can argue or work it out between you. Is that okay, 4 minutes apiece? Okay. Mr. Dittbrenner, I think you were the first one to call, so.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Michael Dittbrenner. I am former chair of the Family Law Section of the State Bar Association. I'm also currently the legislative chair of the Minnesota chapter of the American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers. Because this is rather new legislation that has come up today, neither organization has taken an official position on the legislation, but I can tell you with a strong degree of certainty that my fellow colleagues at our Friday membership meeting are likely to perhaps almost unanimously oppose this legislation. And I think that I want to talk a little bit about the history of it, going back to 2005 when income shares was adopted by the legislature. The 25% parenting time presumption was not opposed at that time by many people because we saw that as reflecting what courts, at least at the bare minimum, were doing in terms of access. Three overnights every 2 weeks, maybe every other weekend from Friday till Sunday, plus an additional overnight on the off week. And so doing that was not doing anything tremendously different at the bare minimum what courts were doing. They were even doing more than that in certain cases. Thus, there was a belief that that was okay. Then to have the different levels of child support depending upon amounts of parenting time. The reason why you had this 0 to 10% pays one level, 10 to 45% pays another level, and 45 to 50% pays another level, was to try to discourage litigation over parenting time based upon somebody's concerns about how much support they were going to be ordered to pay or ordered to receive. The idea being that people should be able then to negotiate in good faith the amount of access without people's motives being suspect. Adding other levels to amounts of child support, having a scheme where between 10 and 30% there's a 12% reduction, and having 30% to 45% being a 30% reduction, means that both parents are going to be fighting with each other over the amount of access based upon their belief that somebody's ox is getting gored. That is going to lead to a tremendous amount of litigation, and I feel that people are going to be prevented from experimenting with levels of parenting time, which may otherwise be in their children's best interest, because they perceive that there is a financial problem associated with it that could be quite costly for either of them. And I don't think that is very reasonable. The other concern that I have with just simply having a 40% presumption of parenting time is one size doesn't really fit all. There are a number of reasons why more or less parenting time would be inappropriate in a particular case. It's dependent upon the children's ages. It's dependent upon the parents' distance from each other, the distance from the children's school, how involved each of them were in the children's education, how much they will continue to be involved in the children's education after the divorce. And to simply assume that 40%, which is about 5 out of 14 overnights, is the standard, I think, is not the way to go. There are so many different things that could determine what parenting time is appropriate. So I view this legislation as doing the opposite of what the witnesses beforehand have said. It's going to increase litigation. It's going to be a Fair Employment Act for lawyers, because people will be going to court to modify the amount of the child support obligation because of the perception that they can get just over 30% of the time or a greater amount of time than that, but that will lead them to have a lower support obligation. Thank you.
Yeah. Good timing. Next was, Judge Kloss.
Thank you.
Or I guess former.
Retired, right.
Or retired, probably still on the bench.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Mullery, members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you. I have been a lawyer for 50 years, which is really rather daunting when I look in the mirror. And I've been retired for 8 years, almost 9 years, from the Ramsey County Bench, where I served for 14. Prior to my being appointed on the bench, I limited my practice to family law because it was the family law cases were on the desk, the others were on the credenza, and that wasn't fair to the people back there. I have continued my interest in family law. I do not consider it be a nuisance or whatever other judges may now and then in frustration explain. Representative Mahoney has recast his bill, which last session provided for a presumption for joint physical custody, into one which has a presumption of parenting time adjustments and schedules, but it legally has the same effect. And I agree with Mike that it will, whereas now about 95% of family law cases settle, what you've heard from the people in favor of this legislation are the exceptions. And if this bill passes, those exceptions will become the norm. As the Joint Custody Study Committee found when looking at the research that has been done and printed, in Washington and Oregon, which have a presumption for joint physical custody, litigation, once it was passed, litigation went through the ceiling. In Minnesota, because 95% of the cases now settle, with this kind of incentive, financial as well as psychological incentive to fight about how much time each has, the litigation will go through the roof, and the court system, which you've been hearing from our Chief Justice, to your dismay or your delight, whichever way you take it, our court system is under duress, as you are, as legislators, as we all are in this economy. And if this legislation were to pass, litigation would rise. In addition to the other many types of problems that are coming to the court, and I suggest the court would simply, family law would simply shut down. So I urge that you look carefully and not pass this legislation.
Thank you, Judge Kloss. Glenn Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Glenn Norton. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota State Bar Association Family Law Section. I'm the chairman of the legislative committee for the Family Law Section. And I wanted to say, first of all, we're 100% unpaid volunteers. Our constituents are the people in the family court and the attorneys that serve them. Our concern is to pursue what's best for families, not what's best for lawyers. Although we've been accused of other things, the facts are different. And the bottom line is, our committee has reviewed this particular piece of legislation. Our committee has also reviewed the former legislation proposing joint physical custody. We stand unanimously opposed. And the reason is that we don't think it's best for families. We don't think it's best for the system. We don't think it's best for children. Our committee has reviewed all these proposals in the context of what will happen if we have to work with this. We continue to oppose it because the judges are our best friends when we get to court. The judges take these cases and they look to see what's best for these people. Not what rubber stamp fits the case, but what's best for these people in front of us. This is the thing we want. This is not what we want to get away from. We want to empower those judges. The way we empower the judges is get rid of presumptions. We allow the judges to have the freedom to say, this is what's best for this child in front of me now. This is what we're trying to do. This bill goes the other way. For that reason, our section and our committee is opposed to it. We're opposed to the idea of adding more time, tiers of parenting time. For the reason that you've heard from the previous two speakers, it encourages arguments over, you know, I want to be over that threshold, not under that threshold, because I want the financial benefit of being over that threshold. Naturally, that's the way people argue. That's the way people think. So what we do in the current legislation is we say the extremes on either end get one treatment each, but most people get average treatment, and they get the average results of the child support legislation calculated according to the calculator. If you have special exceptions, we have a tool for that too. What I'm saying in the most general summary is we've got a tool to do all the things we're seeking to do in this legislation already. We don't need more legislation. What we have, if we need equal parenting time, we have a way to do that. If we need 40% parenting time, we have a way to do that. You just have to convince the judge or the opposing party and their attorney, and the deal's okay. Now, there are some aberrations, and we don't want to seem insensitive. There are some aberrations. The system isn't perfect every time. And the people we hear from, I'm sorry they have bad time. I'm sorry it's expensive. I'm sorry that this isn't always perfect for them. But for the bulk of the people, it is working. And that's why it is the way it is. There isn't a stampede of people saying we need this other change. So we're sorry it isn't working for the exceptions, but I think the majority of the people aren't here because it's working for the majority of the people. We support improvement of family law. We support an analysis of anything that could improve our practice and the lives of the people we help. So we do support the idea of gathering further demographic data. The study that was conducted, we support that. We endorse that study. There were many professionals without a horse in the game or without a horse in the race that helped do that study. And so we do support that, and the conclusion that comes to mind first to me is get more data. If we're going to make a change, let's measure it and know what we're changing and how it's going to help.
Thank you. Mr. Elwood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. Before I start, I just want to say that it pains me to be here opposing Representative Mahoney's bill because, first of all, I respect the emotional turmoil experienced by the testifiers and others in their situation, and also to oppose Representative Mahoney on this bill where he's always been a champion for our clients. And I know he's really sincere in his belief that this is a good idea. That said, though, I must do my job. We all must do our jobs. And our practitioners believe that this is an inadvisable proposal. Let me just make a few points. First, the study group that's been referred to did not look at this proposal. And if Judge Kloss is right, and this is essentially the same idea as they are tantamount to a presumption of joint physical custody, the study group did not endorse that idea. Further, there's really no evidentiary basis that going from 25 to 40% is in the best interest of any particular child in any particular situation. Further, there's really no assurance that the 40% time will actually be spent, but yet the child support would be reduced by 30%, and if the actual time does not equal 40% or even around that, the amount of money is still reduced. And finally, I just would suggest that what I see is, and we see as a fundamental flaw in the proposal, is that creating presumptive agreements in a small percentage of cases where it's the highest conflict seems to me both counterintuitive and simply not in the best interest of the child, which after all is what all of this is about. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today.
Thank you. Ms. Cunningham, did you want to, there's about a minute and a half left, if you can. And would the others stay down here because
there's going to be, I'm sure, questions on this, I would guess.
I just happened to be here during this. I've been aware that this bill has been in. I am not associated with anyone, so I hope I can assist your this side. I am speaking against the bill. I'll try to take what I said. The role and responsibility of making this public policy is an ominous position, and you hold many people's lives in your hands, especially our children. And unfortunately for me, these laws, that is the missing piece. The children are being left out in the needs and the desires of the parents to have their parenting responsibilities or rights. The parenting rights are taking precedence over the children's rights, in my experience. In my research and trying to figure out, I didn't know until yesterday morning that I was even going to attempt to even come, let alone speak to this. But in doing the research that I had to follow up on what this is, there are vendettas out there against particular judges and bases for why this is. I recently had my divorce a year and a half ago. It was before one of these referees. What I ended up with, against many people's judgments, is a 50-50 custody situation. As of right now, as we're speaking, my ex is being evicted from his home. I have encouraged my two boys, who need him desperately, to be a part of their process of moving their belongings and proceeding with that. I am not against, I believe, father's rights or father's responsibilities. We need everybody in our community and in our families to help support our children, in particular our males, to grow up. That, again, what was just said, the presumption that people can, that all parents can support children through whatever percentage of 40 or 50% is not necessarily accurate. The laws are on the books right now where with domestic violence, with violence to my children and such, this should never have been. My ex had pro bono work done by a lawyer who was for this kind of an environment. And so he had the power to push this through. I didn't realize that until yesterday morning because I had not done this amount of research during my divorce process. I now see what I was up against and what my children were up against. My children are not being financially supported, emotionally supported, or in any other fashion. It was a matter of time and possession. Our children are not to be split with property just as our houses and our finances are. So that is my say as just an individual parent who has recently experienced. I think the empirical data does need to be looked at. I would really be interested to see what the courts are currently doing for that. Many people's hearts, including my own and lives, and the people that are sitting behind me, who I feel very compassionate for, and lives have been destroyed. But they have been destroyed prior to the divorces and through the divorces, not just in the short amount of time that we get our children to try to impact.
Thank you. Okay, then we'll open it up to questions. And Representative Champion, you're the first one.
Just as a point of clarification, the gentleman on the on my left, yes,
Mr. Norton.
Mr. Norton indicated that I think he said something around presumption shouldn't be something that the court takes into consideration, or the best interest of the child is the analysis. But I noticed, Mr. Norton, under Minnesota Statute 518.17, Subdivision 1E, as well as Minnesota Statute 518.17, Subdivision 2, that the law already clearly outlines presumptions that the court takes into consideration. So I want to understand, if you'll help me, why a rebuttable presumption of 40% is not appropriate here, when in fact that the court has already outlined in two separate places or spaces under the notion of family law, where there should be a rebuttable presumption. And then my second question, once that's answered, is how did the court, or how did we come to 25% being an a presumption that we're okay with under Minnesota Statute 518.17 Subdivision 2, and now we're having some resistance, for lack of a better word, to the notion of an increased presumptive number?
Mr. Norton.
Thank you. As to the question of the presumptions now, the concern that we have is the presumption ties the hands of the court in the broad range of discretion and predicts or directs what the decision should be absent a separate special piece of proof.
And so in some instances, a presumption might be a useful thing. I'm not sure without pulling out my statute book exactly which one we're talking about with the citations you've given me, but there are occasions where you might use a presumption. The problem is when we're dealing with unique things like children and their relationship with their parents, we shouldn't be presuming anything upon the court as far as how it should decide. We should allow the court to figure all those factors, the 13 factors, into the decision. That's why I oppose these presumptions. That's why the Bar Association opposes these presumptions. The family law section has looked this stuff over and has consistently opposed the idea of a presumption and consistently opposed the idea of joint physical custody.
So is it fair to say
in the
Okay, so is it fair to say that the Bar Association does not support any presumptions, because under the law right now it clearly states under Minnesota Statute 518.17, the court shall use a rebuttable presumption that upon request of either or both parties, joint legal custody is in the best interest of the child. Now, is my understanding of that is that it does not remove the possibility for the court to look at this being a starting place, but use some other factors which are clearly articulated in 518.17, that the court can look at these other things.
Representative Mallory and Representative Champion.
Yes.
If I may, over the years, the family law and this family law community and this legislature has wrestled with how to make the separation of families and the life after separation more less litigious, more easy, less heartbreaking. And so we've developed things such as presumptions. And a rebuttable presumption, I would say, as a former English teacher, is a contradiction in terms of it. In any event, the legislature seems quite enamored of that term. And we've used it quite a few times. But I think that at this point, certainly 30 years after I started wrestling with this, we've come to the conclusion that maybe presumptions aren't such a good thing. Maybe what we really need in each separation of families is what's gone on with the family before they came to court, what's going on now, and what would be best that went on in the future. So there's some movement to suggest to learned members of this body that we should do away with all presumptions so that the evidence about each unique family as it comes before the court, and if we don't have presumptions, maybe we'll continue to have only 5% come before the court. The other 95% will agree. And maybe that could continue.
There must be 1,000 presumptions.
Okay, but I got
Representative Champion.
I promise this is my last question, but I know lawyers should never say that this is our last question. Judge, I understand and respect so greatly the fact that you've been a lawyer for 50 years, and definitely you are much more seasoned than I am. But perhaps you can lend me some of that insight as to how the court looks at, as well as how you believe that consent is a good starting number for 518.175, and why this other number would not be a good idea.
Representative Champion, Representative Mallory, I don't believe 25% is a good starting point. I think what I'd really like, but it doesn't happen now because the presumptions have come into the common view of anyone going into court is, oh, well, the court's going to order joint custody, joint legal custody, and probably joint physical custody. So what do we have to do to fight against that? What I would really like is to have a level playing field when a family comes into court, that there be evidence brought into court which talks about how the family managed its parenting, its finances, its everything, before one of them decided to make a split, how they're doing now after that split has started, and what would be best as to how they do in the future. I'd like it a level playing field. It's not now.
Representative Mahoney, you wanted to comment on that.
Well, Mr. Chair, and members, I could ask a number of questions. I'll ask this one. It's interesting that we can come up with an actual percentage now, but throughout the whole joint physical custody hearing, no one could come up with any percentage because we didn't do any studies past 1997. But Oregon's law has been brought up time and time again as to the significant amount of litigation. Oregon has, I'm not sure whether it's 7 or 8 stages of custody or visit parenting plans, and 7 or 8 stages of monetary discounts. Primarily, the cause is that they have so many, and every time that changes, they have to go back to court. I could say a lot, having spent 5 years on this particular issue, and argued many places but I will just allow the testifiers. If you'd like to bring down any of my testifiers, Mr. Chair? If they're here.
There was no question for your testifiers. Representative Johnson, I believe you're next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just looking at the bill here, as I understand it, I guess Judge Klaus would ask you this. In the vast majority of the cases, families that are dissolving, and this is such a terribly hard time for families, they're going to come to some agreement on how to make arrangements between themselves.
Right.
Isn't that correct?
95% of them do.
Ms. Klaus.
And the law allows that. And it allows if two reasonable parents come together and agree on something, it can be joint legal, joint physical, joint you know what. If they present that to a court, the court should accept it. In most cases, does. In fact, there's a bill that was introduced this morning that you will be hearing sometime that says if there are some strange places in the state of Minnesota where a judge would not accept freely arrived at agreement, we're going to call them out and say that that's the wrong way to behave.
Representative Johnson.
Paul, the fact that there's 40% cited in here doesn't mean that they have to make that arrangement of 40%. That just sets a benchmark amount of time to consider. Do I get that correct as I look at this?
Judge Klaus.
It doesn't have to be 40%.
Representative Mullery, Representative Johnson, that's right. However, the word will get out and the assumption will be that that's what the judge is going to order or the referee is going to order, and the defenses arise and the fight is joined. That's what scares me.
Just one last question. And if the judge thinks that there are problems, let's say, with abuse or something of that sort, doesn't the judge have the right to reduce the amount of time and cite why?
Ms. Klaus.
Representative Mullery, Representative Johnson, yes, that's true. But I believe some previous speaker said judges are not educated, alert, sensitive to. They don't see domestic violence in these cases, and I don't want to attribute reasons, but certainly the fact that if you look at a case that is coming before you as one of the many in a dissolution calendar and say, hey, wait a minute, this doesn't smell right, or I think there's some problem, and you stop and investigate, you're throwing the whole calendar into disarray. You're taking more time. It's a difficult clog that isn't running the system right, and that may be one of the reasons. But I can tell you that domestic violence, as Ms. Cunningham pointed out, domestic violence is often involved in cases, but it's not revealed, because it's shameful, or it's not detected because it's, people aren't listening. And then she has a joint legal and joint physical custody, and she had domestic violence in her situation. That should never have occurred.
Representative Johnson. Okay, Representative Jackson.
For those in the family court system, I just want some confirmation of what has been my experience as an attorney for not quite as long, 24 years, but I had it for years of family law practice, and I found that in the percentage of cases where people could not come to resolution themselves, that custody was often used as leverage in fighting over everything from support to property division. Just let me know if you can confirm that's your experience too.
It is mine, Representative Jackson.
Judge Block.
Michael Dipperner, Mr. Chair, Representative Jackson. Yeah, sometimes that does occur where custody is leveraged with other issues being involved too. This bill gives greater opportunities for leverage, I should point out, because it now has between 30% and 45% to pay one level of child support, and between 10% and 30% to pay another level.
Representative Jackson.
My next question for confirmation, as a person who has been through the system and gotten divorced and paid child support, I found the current law to be absolutely gender neutral in my case. Now, maybe, the judges in my district are just real, real fair, but that was my experience, and I just want some confirmation that as they are written, they are gender neutral.
I assume we're not going to ask the judge. they have to practice in front of judges, so I don't know which one wants to answer.
The Chair, Representative Jackson, I have found them to be applied gender neutrally, and I found them to be written gender neutrally. I think that the problem in cases are the high conflict cases, and those are the cases in which you have chemical dependency issues, you have mental illness, and then most commonly it's when one or both parties have a personality disorder that makes them unable to feel empathy for the other parent and for the children. They may be narcissistic, they may be borderline, but they have such a lack of self-awareness, and they're more apt to litigate and fight over every possible thing. And they make up the great number of the cases that take up a lot of judicial time and effort. My concern is with this legislation, we're going to be having regular people litigate over parenting time, and we'll be injecting them into the system of litigation. So it'll be more than just the personality disorder cases.
Representative Jack. Okay, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess the question would go to the two attorneys up here. We talked a little bit about the cases in Oregon and was it Idaho or one of the other western states, and you indicated that there was an increase in litigation when the presumption of joint physical custody was present. Could it be that these cases are just, the increase in cases is because the non-custodial parents are just now, with the change in law, are seeing a glimmer of hope and they're rushing to the courts to try to get back some of their parenting rights that have been really diminished over the years.
Mr. Dittbrenner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, it may be that there are parents that are indeed doing that to try to restore their parenting rights, but there are also going to be other parents whose motives are perhaps not as pure, who are basically going back to court to achieve a reduction in their support obligation, and having these different levels of child support depending upon how much access has encourages that.
Representative Scott, further?
I think we have that now. I think we have that going on now. So I don't know that this is going to... I'm a believer that children need both parents in their lives, and right now that's not happening as a general rule. So... I'm just concerned. I believe this would help move things in that direction. I have studies up here that say that it is beneficial to the children, and someone earlier stated that it wasn't, that there are no studies out there that indicated that it was, and I believe that it is. The children are they have less behavior problems. They have less problems adjusting. And I think if we looked at the court systems, juvenile court and see who, which children are more likely to be offenders. I would say the majority of those are probably from a single parent household where maybe no, both parents aren't really involved. And I wonder if you could speak to that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, it's precisely because you have the same amount of child support being paid, regardless of whether you have 10 or 11% of the time or 35% of the time, that there isn't a lot of litigation over parenting time because there's no incentive. There's nothing to be gained by increasing access from 3 overnights every 2 weeks to 5 overnights every 2 weeks. Once you have these different levels, you increase those incentives dramatically. And yes, it will lead to litigation. And quite frankly, I mean, one size does not fit all. It may be that there are certain appropriate cases to have equal access or to have 40% access. But that depends on so many variables. And to create a presumption that 40% is the way to go, and that's where we should start with, basically takes all these cases and treats them alike when there are so many different reasons why there should be different types of access arrangements.
Just one last comment. I see that as what's going on now. We have a presumption of what 20 or 25%. That's what is the norm. Am I right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, I see that more as being the bare minimum that judges do. I see a lot of judicial experimentation, and I see a lot of different types of recommendations coming from custody evaluators, where there's going to be recommendations for 3 out of 14 overnights, 4 out of 14, 5 out of 14, 1 week on, 1 week off. But the sad thing is that now people are going to oppose levels of access because they see themselves as getting less support, or people are going to be demanding more levels of access because they see something to be gained with a reduction of child support. And that's tragic, to tie parenting time like that to levels of child support, because it means that everybody is going to be suspect based upon the position they're taking for the number of overnights.
And Representative Mulvey, Representative Scott, if I could just say, remember, there are 95% of families going into court who agree. Those families who can agree have not written to you, I would gainsay, and they're doing just fine. Whatever arrangement they arrived at, reasonably, without duress, is what the family probably should have.
Representative Mahoney, did you want to...
Well, I want to make a response to some of these, and then I'm going to change my motion, if I could, Mr. Chair, because we are out of time. Judge, you should really come down to a construction trailer with me, with the other 50 construction workers. You go to every table, and four out of, if there's eight people divorced, the non-custodial parents, the one with 25%, basically got 20% of the time because they ran out of money. They run out of money.
There is no applause here.
They run out of money. They can't afford $350 an hour lawyers to continue to go into court. That's why you get 95% settled. Mr. Chair, I'd like to lay this bill over until we hear Representative Paymar's bill, and then we can have an even fuller discussion.
Okay. The author has requested that the chair lay it over, correct?
Yes.
Thank you, okay. Mr. Chair.
The chair then lays the bill over, and we are adjourned. Mm-hmm.